Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur in the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi on this Monday. Joining me on the other end of the line, I just call him Rob. A lot of people call him the Heffinator, Rob Heflin. Rob, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, sir. How are you doing?
Did you just have some flashbacks on doing those takes a couple of times?
I did have some flashbacks to about 2000 and when was that? 2002 when we were filming Shallow Rob on VHS tape. And I can remember all of that stuff coming back when I'm listening to you talk.
Rob and I have been friends a long, long time. Our friendship originated on the old MS Ducks, and Rob actually became my first guide at Mossy Island Outfitters in 1999.
We had some good times, didn't we?
You know, I tell everybody all the time, when the subject of bands come up, there is nobody that can be a witness in this world than you as it pertains to bands if locations are the most important thing in killing bands. And you know what I mean by that.
Yeah.
You killed 7 in one spot in 1 year. Not you yourself, but people you were guiding.
Yeah, 7 in 1 year. And I don't think I have killed a band since then. But that was 98-99 season. We had such a good duck season. And you were booking hunts because Arkansas was locked up. They were having to cancel hunts, and we were hunting, and it was just like magic, man. Everywhere you went, you were killing ducks. And I don't think it's been a duck season that good since then.
You know, Rob, all that time that you were game, Rob went on to be a game warden later on after making bukoodles of money from me and retiring off. He decided he was going to become a game warden.
Made my next million working for the state government, right?
You know, everybody, when they talk about you and knowing that we're good friends, they're always like, hey, what was Rob like before he was a game warden? And my answer always, always is, he's just like he is as a game warden. He followed the law to the T. And I'll give a great example of that. Now, let's see if you remember this hunt. You took me on a hunt. You had ducks that were landing in a ditch. And I think it may have been soybeans on one side, cotton field on the other. And it was hundreds and thousands of ducks landing in this flume ditch. And we got there before daybreak, set out a couple of decoys, you know, that 10 minutes before shooting time, sky just got black. All you hear, mallards.
Yeah.
The ditch is full. This thing is maybe 15 foot wide. I mean, it is slap full of ducks 2 minutes before shooting time. I'm like, Rob, let's start shooting. They can't get into the ditch. No more can fit in this ditch. You're like, no. We got 2 minutes left.
Yeah.
We got 2 minutes to shooting time. And that's seriously who you were even before you came to game warden.
Well, you know, I wasn't always like that. I got started hunting late in my life because my dad didn't hunt, and his dad didn't hunt, so I didn't know anything about hunting. But a good friend of mine invited me on a deer hunt when I was 12, and he had been hunting all his life. Paul Towns in the fourth. He's president of Guaranty Bank in Indianola. And he invited me on a deer hunt down at Reed Deer Camp, Fittler, Mississippi, on the Mississippi River down there. So Paul went off to his own stand, and I went with Paul's dad, Mr. Paul. And he laughs telling the story about I got scared by an armadillo coming through the woods and wanted to know was it going to bite me. And I didn't know anything about being in the woods, you know. And I shot a doe. And I remember they bloodied my face up at Reed Deer Camp, and it was the first deer I'd ever killed. And I asked for a shotgun for the next Christmas, and I could have asked my mom for a stripper, and I think she'd rather give me that than the shotgun. This guns just terrified her, you know. And so I started hunting, and I mean we went through the stage of. We went down the old railroad track bed behind my house, which is four-lane highway now in Silver City, and loaded up that shotgun with slugs, a buckshot one. Dad gave me that shotgun. We went hunting, and we didn't even know how to unload a shotgun after you loaded it back. So I can remember standing there shooting all those shells out of that shotgun because we didn't know. I mean, that's how ignorant my family was about hunting when I grew up. Didn't know about the magazine release and you pump them out, you know. And anyway, so I went from being that ignorant about hunting to getting myself into duck hunting when I was a junior in high school, and just kind of fell into duck hunting. I guess I never could sit still enough to be a good deer hunter, but really enjoyed duck hunting. And I don't know why, but ended up being pretty good at it. And started guiding for different people when I was in college. My first duck guiding job was down at, they call it Black Bear Hunt Club now, but they had bought the land that Reed Deer Camp hunted, and it was 15,000 acres of cottonwood plantation. They grew cottonwood for paper products, toilet paper.
I forgot about that.
All that kind of stuff. Yeah, I guided for Jackie Kerr. Her husband, Ronnie Kerr, was a game warden in Issaquena County, and guided for her while I was going to Mississippi State. And, you know, when I was home on the weekends or Christmas break or whatever, and we didn't do pay hunts. We just did people who bought paper from that company. I think it was Crown Vantage at the time. Did hunts for her, and it was really laid back, a really nice lodge. My mom always wanted me to be, you know, Mr. Etiquette and Mr. GQ, and once I got into hunting, I was always wearing camouflage. You know, I was at school wearing camouflage when everybody else was wearing nice clothes. I had camouflage on like a little nerd, and I learned how to set the table, knife on the right, fork on the left, big spoon on the inside, a little spoon on the outside, all at duck camp. And I said, see, Mom, I got manners being a duck guide. So, I guided a little bit for Don Clark when he had Dutch Break Outfitters up at Inverness. And Don and I are good friends to this day. Don Clark and Bo Sloan had that. And Bo is a refuge manager over at White River Refuge in Arkansas now. And every duck hunter knows about White River Refuge. But I guided for those two guys for a little while. And then I started kind of doing a little bit on my own. We had some catfish ponds. And if you're hunting around Belzona or your place up in Morgan City, everybody knows catfish ponds are kind of a part of the duck hunting staple in the central Mississippi Delta, Sunflower and Humphreys County anyway. And
the thing about a catfish pond that people don't understand, historically they sit on some of the lowest ground in the Mississippi Delta. And
that's right.
Historically holds water, which in turn historically holds ducks. And that's why a lot of times you can, man, even if it's not a working pond, you can drain it down and plant it and it'll fill up with ducks.
Yeah, that was the last places, I guess, to be cleared up when everybody was clearing land to plant soybeans, and a lot of those properties that are now catfish pond got cleared back in the 60s and early 70s when soybean prices went sky high and folks were clearing trees out of places that, you know, honestly should have never been cleared, I don't guess. But anyway, they put catfish ponds on them, and I was raised on a catfish farm. My grandfather had about 600 acres, but a lot of diver duck hunting on those ponds when they're, you know, 3 or 4 feet deep. And but anyway, I got it for different people, and then you and I met, and we've been friends ever since. I guess that was 98, somewhere around there. And
best friends. I consider you one of my, I may not be in your category, but you're one of my best friends that I could, he's one, Rob is one of those people that I can call him. We just talked yesterday. It doesn't matter. If it was truly a year and a half ago, it doesn't matter. We pick up right where we left off.
Yep.
But I want to say this before we jump into any game warden stories. I want to say this about the Rob Heflin I know. Okay? There's three things that this man is passionate about, and he may want to comment after, but one is duck hunting. Golly, I mean, it's the passion that kind of brought us together to be the friends that we are. Two is flying. I mean, I have to say it. You know, you kind of cultivated a love that I've had since I was a kid in me going on to be a pilot, to fly. Rob, I used to fly with Rob everywhere, scouting when he was guiding for me. Good Lord, dude, come on, let's jump in the plane and go look. You know, it take 10, 15 minutes to cover the ground that it used to take 2 or 3 hours to cover in a truck, do it in an airplane.
You know, that niche story you were just talking about, that's how I found those ducks the day before in that ditch, and I never would have gone to that ditch. It's just a field ditch, you know? Who would have set up decoys in the ditch, you know? And but I saw all those ducks sitting in that ditch from the airplane, and the afternoon before, and I said, that's where we're going the next morning. And I remembered you were like, why do you take him to a ditch, you know? And I think he thought I was crazy until the ducks started coming in. But,
whew,
yeah.
Man. And I say that third, and most of all, and I think that this is where his – Rob is a black and white guy. And I don't mean that in the racial sense. I mean that in that's how life operates. And I think that's how a lot of us should be. There's no gray. There really isn't any gray area. Everything in life is black and white. And that's his belief in God and Jesus Christ. And, you know, man, I don't know what I'd have done in parts of my life without the friendship of the man that's on the line with us. Because it hadn't always been a wonderful, easy walk. But he's never strayed from that path. And it's cool to watch from a distance. That's who Rob is.
Well, you're talking about number three, Rocky. And I know you and I have been through some really great times and some really bad times. And I believe for both of us, if we hadn't been Christians, had faith in the Lord, that we probably wouldn't have made it through those bad times like we did. You know, a lot of people turn to different things, and I'm not going to preach, but a lot of people turn to drugs or sex or alcohol or whatever else, and everybody has their own thing. What gets you doesn't get me, and vice versa. But I tell you, I'm not going to get into it, but the last 3 years has been one of the lowest points of my life. If it hadn't been for the Lord, I probably wouldn't be here, you know. So that did bring us together. We made other good friends, you know, Brian McKay, and it's just cool to see how our faith has held us through the tough times and made us better friends, you know.
I agree. But when I thought about bringing, you know, I asked a question about a month ago about, hey, you know, would you like to hear from the other side. Because right now on the podcast, we've got two guys that were got in trouble with the feds. It's a long, great story. I'm sure a lot of you are listening to Foles and Ryan Warden, two great stories. But I think it's time to hear some stuff from the other side. Now, Rob, when I told you going into this, I don't want details like who, what, I think you knew that going in. But if there's somebody with great stories as it pertains to wildlife and hunting, getting another perspective on from the other side, it's Rob.
You know, Rocky, when you asked me about that, I used to write articles for the Mississippi Wildlife Enforcement Officers Association magazine, which comes out two or three times a year. And then I became the editor of that magazine, so I was getting stories from officers all across Mississippi and editing them, even though I talk like I graduated from third grade. Once I type it on the paper, I know where the commas and the periods and the sentence fragments and all that. So I have had a little bit of schooling, but I used to put that magazine together.
Don't let him lie to you.
I know it.
He is highly intelligent. Were you the valedictorian of your senior, large senior class, or the salutatorian? Which one?
The salutatorian. But
that's what I thought.
Yeah. But anyway, forgot where I was going with that. Oh, yeah, talking about the stories. I always wrote my things down after I made a case. Number one, for court, because, you know, you make a big case one afternoon. Well, after everything's wrapped up, I would come home, and it might be 10, 11 o'clock at night, and I would try to type it all out so that the next case I made, the details wouldn't pollute my memory of that. Because, you know, two people can see the same thing happen, and they both write it down, and there may be details one guy left out that the other guy wrote. I mean, that's the case with the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You got the same story written down by four different people, you know. But I always try to write my stuff down, and then when it came time to write stories about it, I left their names out.
You know how to do this well, then.
Well, I didn't include pictures with their faces. And the point I'm trying to make is we have all messed up. We've all done stupid stuff. We've all done stuff that we wish we could go back and redo. And, you know, I get a guilt trip thinking about some of the stuff I've done. And the devil puts that guilt on you. But so when I tell my stories, I don't want to bring up a bad memory from somebody and then, you know, they're mad at me all over again or whatever. Because I've done stuff and if people told stories about me, I would be embarrassed. You know what I mean. So I try to make these stories interesting, but not let you know who did it or maybe let a few years pass before tell that story. So I don't want anybody listening to this to think I'm singling them out. Cause I'm friends with a lot of people that I made cases against when I was an officer. That's just the nature of the job.
Hey, tell this story. I want to hear this story first and let everybody know, because I think it'll be a great opener. But how did you get to be a game warden?
Well, like I told you, I went deer hunting for the first time when I was 12 and just really got really just interested in hunting as I got older and then got into duck hunting when I was about 17 and started guiding. And I've always wanted to fly since I was a little kid, and I wanted to go into the Air Force and wasn't able to do that. And then I decided I wanted to be a crop duster because if you're a pilot around the Mississippi Delta, more than likely you're an attack pilot, and never could get into that. It's a hard business to get into, number one, but I started a ground spraying business where I had a rogator, everybody calls it, you know, spraying crops, and I thought maybe I would work into flying after that, get an airplane or something, but I helped my mom and dad on their catfish ponds, and and my grandfather's catfish ponds. And anyway, the fish industry started going south. Everybody was getting out of business. A lot of folks were going bankrupt, and I had just gotten married. And I said, you know, I've got to find a steady job. And so I thought about it, and I said, you know, I might like to be a game warden. And I didn't have a first ounce of knowledge about law enforcement at all, but I knew hunting and fishing, and I saw how people acted, and I'm not saying I never broke a wildlife law, because I have, and I never got caught, but I saw things were happening around the places where I hunted. You know, I said, you know, man, if I was a game warden, I could catch that fella. And anyway, so I applied for the job they were hiring back in, I guess it was 2003, and Mr. Gerald Holloway, he's passed away now, but Mr. Gerald Holloway came and sat down in my kitchen and talked to me and my wife and asked me why I wanted to be a game warden. I think every game warden, when they're asked why they want to be a game warden, they say, well, I love hunting and fishing. Well, you don't realize when you get hired to be a game warden that most of your hunting and fishing is fixing to end, because every opening day, every weekend, you're out there working when 95% of the population is off work, you know, hunting. And anyway, but I just like the outdoors, and I needed a steady job, so I applied with the Mississippi Department of Wildlife Fisheries Department. They hired me, and I was there 14 years, and I enjoyed
it. But that is that school, man, that school is tough.
Well, they sent us to the Mississippi Law Enforcement Officers Training Academy in Pearl, Mississippi. And we're there for 10 weeks. It's called basic training. The guys that were our instructors were, most of them were Highway Patrol, Mississippi Highway Patrol, state troopers. But most of those guys had been in the Marines, or some branch of the military before they became state troopers. So they ran basic training just like, I can't say just like because I've never been to military boot camp, but they ran it, what I consider pretty similar to a military boot camp. That was 10 weeks, and all of the conservation officers, I call them game wardens, but all the game wardens were there, but guys that got hired to be sheriff's deputies, police departments from all around the state, narcotics guys, alcohol guys, different, and women, but different agencies all there together doing the same basic training where we go through, hand-to-hand fighting techniques, shooting, defensive driving, go through all the laws, constitutional stuff, you know, search and seizure, all of that kind of stuff for 10 weeks, and wake you up in the middle of the night, make you go out to the flagpole, do mountain climbers. We marched with our mattress on our head one night in formation for about, I can't remember how many miles that was, and around the driving track while we're singing in cadence the whole time with our mattresses on our heads walking around, and it was that kind of stuff for 10 weeks, and it was meant to weed out the folks who didn't need to be there and make everybody else realize that you can endure more than you think you can. And then after that, they sent us to, I think it was 10 weeks when I went through it, of conservation officer school. And that was just a little more laid back at the time. Now they've ramped it up pretty intense. But that's where we learned all the hunting and fishing, trapping laws, commercial fishing, you know, practicing stopping vehicles at night after they've simulated they'd shot off the road and that kind of stuff. And so that was all focused that last 10 weeks on game and fish stuff. But, yeah, about 20 weeks now, I think they've got it up to 24 weeks. What game wardens in Mississippi go through before they're turned loose out in the field. And then they have it's a 6-month field training officer program where that new officer is paired up with an older officer, and they ride together for about 6 months straight, and then the older guy is teaching the newer guy what to do, what to look for. Because you come out of the academy, it's kind of like coming out of college. You got a degree, but you really don't have any real world experience, you know. So that FTO program gives those new guys real world experience. And then there's another 6 months of relaxed. That new officer can kind of ride around by himself, but he's got to report directly to his FTO. And then they're turned loose. So it's a lot of training that goes into a conservation officer hitting the field by himself, you know.
Well, it is it's a sacrifice every day, because it's not like you're going out there and if there's one underpaid job in this world, in this state, it's our game wardens, because everybody you deal with has a weapon. Just about everybody.
Yep.
Besides fishing. And it's a tough.
Fishing, most folks have a knife when they're fishing, or a pistol, or, you know, a treble hook hurts too.
I'll say this, Rob. I don't know if you even had plans for talking about this one or not, but I've told this story a couple of times on the podcast, and I don't know if I've never included a name in it, in this story. Besides, I don't even think I've included your name. But one of my favorite all-time stories is the teal hunt, and I've told this story like twice. You probably hadn't even heard me tell it.
Yeah, I've heard it. Yeah. Yeah, some of those guys were friends of mine and are still friends of mine. I'm just one of those deals where I made a mistake, you know.
Hey, I gotta say this, though.
Having to pay for it.
I'm gonna clear this record forevermore on this story. You had no idea, really and truly, who was hunting this hole.
I didn't even know if anybody was going to hunt the hole. Of course, I think those guys thought I knew they were going to hunt it, and I set them up to be busted by the feds. But honestly, honest to goodness, I had no idea who or even if anybody would be in that spot. It just had a lot of teal on it. And I found...
All right. That's right. The backstory to this, and I think it's got to be said, it was one of the only spots. The feds have been flying like the week before the whole Delta, and it was one of the only spots in the Mississippi Delta that was holding teal. Am I right on that?
I will say they were flying, and I had found the teal a few days before. They called me and said, hey, we found a spot with a lot of blooming teal. And then I realized what spot they were talking about, and they said, who hunts it? And I said, you know, I know who owns it. That guy doesn't hunt. I don't know if anybody's going to hunt it. And they said, somebody's going to be there because there's too many birds in there. And I said, you know, honestly, I have no clue. I don't even know. But I did work with the federal guys pretty closely on the bird stuff. I love working dove and duck hunting. And we were authorized to, I guess we were deputy agents of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we were authorized to turn cases over to them and get them out of the county courts and into the federal court. And a lot of times that's what it took, because somebody gets a $25 ticket for some outrageous duck violation. You know, that's not going to stop anybody. I think people got mad at me a lot because I turned stuff over to the feds, but, you know.
Let me ask you this, Rob. All right, I know I'm fast-forwarding this story, but I want you to tell this story from your point of view. When you did find out who it was that morning, as you're a game warden, it's got to be gut-wrenching for you, because it's got to turn knots in your stomach. These people, you know them. They're your friends. They're not. You know what I'm saying? It's got to bring some emotion into the job, is what I'm trying to get at.
It does. Like I said, those guys were in there watching that hole, and me and another guy were riding around checking different holes. So I wasn't even there. And it got to be daylight, and nobody even showed up yet. And the federal guys called us on the phone, and they said, hey, man, nobody's in here. And I said, well, you know, I told y'all I didn't know if anybody would be hunting it. And so it was just a little bit after daylight. You know, you would have been in there duck hunting already if it was regular duck season, I guess. But they said, oh, here comes some people. They're pulling up now. So still, I didn't have a clue who it was, you know. And so they observed them hunting and observed some violations. And they told us to come on out there and assist them. And still, I didn't know who was out there, even after they had gotten, the federal guys had made their presence known. I still didn't have a clue who was out there. And ended up being some pretty good friends of mine. And like I said, they picked the wrong day to mess up. And I know they learned from it, because I didn't have any trouble with them on that point.
That's what I'm trying to get across. It, you know, like that deal. And I've told that story in the Mossy Island Outfitter story, I think, somewhere along the line. So you might want to go back and listen to it. But, you know, you're giving your neighbors that you deal with every day, I guess you weren't in that case because the feds were there, but you're looked to because those feds are never seen again. You're looked to as the bad guy.
Yeah, I think the word got out that I had set them up to be busted by the feds, and I didn't know who was out there until I pulled up on the fish pond levee and said, oh, hey, so-and-so. And, you know, it is pretty stressful because, when you grew up and went to school with these guys and considered them to be friends and neighbors, and then you realize it's them, and you're like, you know, there's nothing I could do. Even if it was something I could do, it wouldn't be right to treat them any different than somebody who was a total stranger to me. And that's the way I always try to handle it. Would I treat this guy the same as the next guy? And not that I wrote a ticket for every single violation on every single person I caught. I think everybody thought I wrote every ticket I could find, but I just tried to treat everybody the same.
That's a great. I want to ask you something. You know, you were always considered. Listen, you're our best friend. Don't take this the wrong way. But you're considered hell on wheels because that's the thing that got around with you. Rob catches you. He's writing you a ticket. No, I don't think so. I think that Rob, if you showed up and somebody didn't have their stamp signed, You probably said, hey, you might want to say, you need to sign that stamp. You need to sign that waterfowl stamp.
I've been out of my pocket. A bunch of times I've been out of my pocket. Hey, go ahead and sign that because it's supposed to be signed. But you know, there's a thing called a floating stamp. And I want to do an interview with you a little closer to duck season. You can go over all the common things I found as a waterfowl enforcement officer, and to keep somebody from getting the ticket, you know, maybe this winter. But yeah, I mean, you know, if somebody had six violations, you might write them for two or three or whatever. And usually, if you loaded them up, I had in the back of my mind, hey, when we get to court, I'm gonna say, hey, you plead guilty to this one, and I'll ask the judge to remand all the rest of them to the file. And that's kind of how it worked, But anyway, when you work your home county, I started out my first 3 years, I worked Quitman County, didn't know anybody there, so it was pretty easy to work because you didn't have lifelong connections to all the people you were dealing with. But when I came back to my home county, Humphreys, I knew everybody. I'd been to school with everybody. I knew all their dads and their moms, and you know, and so it made it harder on me to be fair. But I always tried to be fair, and I can remember
if,
having to write a good friend of mine that was a preacher. he had killed a deer without a license, and I didn't know he had killed this deer without a license. And he called me that night, and he said, "Hey, man," he said, "that deer we had today," he said, "I killed it." And I said, "No, I thought so-and-so you were with killed it," because that's what they told us when I was out there. And I wasn't even working. And I was down there with another guy hunting. And anyway, he said, "No, I ended up killing that deer. And my conscience is getting the best of me, so I got to tell you." And I said, "Well, man, now my conscience is getting the best of me. I got to write you a ticket." And he said, "No, no, you don't. No, you don't. Nobody's going to know. They're not going to know." And I said, "Dude, everybody's going to know." And I said, "If only one person besides you knows, everybody's going to know. And they're going to see how I'm treating you compared to how I'm going to treat them." So I wrote that guy a $600 ticket. And I had tears in my eyes when I handed it to him. And I said, "Man, I'm sorry, but I gotta treat everybody the same." And I can remember laying in bed the night before and I asked my wife, I said, "What should I do? You know, I don't want to write him this ticket, but he's called and admitted he broke the law. And several people know he broke the law. I was the last one to find out about it." And she said, "What would you do if you caught old so-and-so doing the same thing?" I said, "I'd smoke him." She said, "Well, you need to do the same thing to your buddy." And I said, "You know, that's right. Treat everybody the same." But it's hard to do a lot of times. But that's the way I try to be, whether everybody thinks that about me or not. I don't know.
Let me ask you this. Leniency. Showing leniency. When somebody starts being disrespectful, leniency goes out the window, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, people get mad, people get frustrated, and I understand that. But once you start cussing an officer, being combative, being belligerent, you usually get written for every single thing you've done, and then maybe even taken to jail if you're being combative, you know. But I always try to treat people like I would want to be treated if I was them getting checked, and I tried to be respectful. You know, sometimes, I mean, I got a pretty quick temper. I've been working on that a lot over the years. You know, you work with me, nothing though, but try to be professional. But yeah, you know, folks, most folks are out there just to have a good time. They're on the day off. They're in the woods hunting. And every once in a while, folks get ticked off that you disturbed them during their hunt. But, most everybody is just pretty decent sportsman.
Politics ever come in? Did ever get involved in you being a game warden?
No, never. That never came up. No, nobody ever called their congressman and complained on me or you know, knew the governor and tried to get their ticket dropped. And I got sent to the radio room for a couple of weeks because I wouldn't drop a ticket. That never happened.
I think one of the, I don't even know if you can talk about this on the podcast. And if you stop me, if you can't talk about it. But it was summer about 10 years ago. Y'all have been instructed to write life jacket tickets. And you'd written a couple of tickets to different people for not having life jackets out fishing. And you were told to drop one, right? But you'd written a few tickets that day for the same violation. And you kind of said, "No, I'm not dropping that ticket. I'll have to drop everybody else's that I wrote that day." Am I wrong in that story?
No, you're not wrong. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but yeah, I had written some tickets, and I got called and told that I needed to drop the ticket, and I said, "Well, I've already turned them in. They're already up at the court." They said, "Well, you need to go up there and dismiss it." And I said, "Well, I'm in a real bind because I had written, I'm a white guy, you know that. I had written this white kid on the lake a ticket, and they wanted his ticket dropped. And I said, here's the big problem. I said, I wrote a black man ticket for the same violation. Did not realize he was the court clerk's husband. So the court clerk was mad at me because I had written her husband a ticket. I don't know if he had to pay the ticket or not. But I said, if I walk into that courthouse, walk up to this black lady who I respect to this very day, hug her neck whenever I see her. If I walk in there, I'm a white guy. I walk in there and ask for this other white guy's ticket to be dismissed. And I didn't ask for her black husband's ticket to be dismissed. I said, what do you think is going to happen in Mississippi? Well, we've had a history of racial problems over the years. I said, what's that going to look like? I said, it looks like Rob Eplin is giving a white guy a break, but wouldn't give the black guy a break. Well, you're just going to have to go dismiss that ticket. And I said, I will be glad to walk in there if y'all give me something in writing saying that you're requesting this citation be dropped. And I can show that to them and say, hey, they send me something in writing, and they wouldn't do that. And I got taken off of patrol and put in the radio room where I couldn't have a chance to write any more tickets, I guess, as a punishment. And the funny thing about it was guys would call in on the radio wanting a driver's license run or whatever, and I would answer the radio, and they thought I was in my truck on the radio messing with them. So they'd call in again and say, you know, I need to run this license. It's a J5, which is hunting license or whatever. And I would run it. And then my cell phone would ring. And they'd say, Rob, what are you doing, man? I'm trying to call Jackson. I said, I am Jackson. But I'm trying to call on the radio. Would you leave me alone on the radio? I said, I am in the radio room. And they were like, what? And I said, yep. And I would tell them. And they would start laughing. And I would start laughing. So I'd look up the information on the computer, and I'd give it back to them. And so that was a big joke around that I was in the radio room. That didn't last very long. They changed their mind about it pretty quick. And anyway, but yeah, politics is involved more than you realize, because everybody knows somebody to call, you know.
Well, there's multiple cases, man, that you have got. Really, really good stories. What about, I know you've got some good, because there's a lot of duck hunters that's listening to this podcast. Tell me a duck hunting one.
I've been thinking about, you said some of the stories that stood out the most. And I guess the one of the most outstanding cases that I ever made was, I think it was 2007, January of 2007, maybe, or January of 2006. I was in Quitman County, and I don't know if you got a lot of non-Mississippians listening to this thing, but up in the North Mississippi Delta, next to Tallahatchie County, Tallahatchie's a huge duck hunting county. The area manager of O'Keefe WMA called me one morning, and I was at home, and he said, what you doing? I said, I'm still at the house. And he said, man, I've been on the management area, and these guys to the east of the management area, and that management area, O'Keefe, was just about solid woods. It's about 7,000 acres of woods. Had a few fields. But there were some agricultural fields to the east of it that were flooded. And he said, these guys have been shooting all morning long. And this is about 10 o'clock in the morning. He said, they're still shooting. He said, and I can hear a four-wheeler riding. He said, and the four-wheeler's gone back to the camp a couple of times and come back out to the blind. And he said, I've got a funny feeling that they're running ducks back to their camp. And I said, okay, I'm on the way. So I met Robbie at O'Keefe, and we got on the four-wheeler and rode up a little four-wheeler trail. And we were right on the edge of the woods and looked out there, and there was a duck blind out of this, I think it was a soybean field, probably 400 or 500 yards away from the edge of the woods. Robo ducks were spinning out there, and guys were shooting. And a four-wheeler. There was a guy on a four-wheeler, and he had a black lab, I think it was. He got on the four-wheeler, came out of the duck hole, got on the turn row, and started heading towards a duck camp. And I said, man, let's ride around here to the duck camp. I know where their camp is. And I said, let's just check this guy, you know. So we rode around to their camp, and I had been to that camp several times, just talking to these guys before the season, getting to know people. And so we pull in there, and there's an older fella on the four-wheeler with the dog, and he had his shotgun and his hunting clothes and waders. He had six ducks on there, and I talked to him, and we checked his license, checked his stamps, checked his plug, checked his ducks. He appeared to be 100% legal. And later, I got to thinking back about it. I thought, you know, this guy wasn't his normal, happy, joking self that day like he was the other days I had seen him. And so we asked him, is anybody still back in the blind? And he said, yes, one guy, just one person back in the blind. Said, okay. So we left and drove back around there, got back on the four-wheeler, and said, well, you know, cell phone, they probably know we're coming. We might as well go and check them. So Robbie and I rode out to the hole, and as we're riding down the turn road, we get close to the blind. This guy comes out of the back of the blind, the little door. It was all brushed up, the blind was, and he had ducks in each hand. He was holding them by the necks. You know how you pick ducks up by the necks? Two or three foreheads sticking up above his hand. He was holding the ducks, and he came out of the blind, and he looked up, and he saw us on the four-wheeler. I'm not kidding you, it's the funniest thing. He just like froze, did a 180, and went right back into the blind. And Robbie said, did you see that guy? And I said, yeah. So we rode up there, and there was an older fella, another older guy out picking up decoys or whatever he was doing. And we started talking to him, and just shooting the breeze. Hey, how you doing? Y'all had a good hunt, you know, all that stuff. Well, the guy that had gone back into the blind that had two handfuls of ducks, he comes out and he has a spinning wing decoy in his hand. He doesn't have dead ducks anymore. He's got a spinning wing decoy. And I said, hey, man, how you doing? How you doing, sir? And I'm fine. I said, what about those ducks you just had in your hand? He said, well, I didn't have any ducks. I said, yeah, you just had ducks in your hand. You just had some ducks in your hand when you came out of the blind. No, I didn't have any ducks. And I was like, okay. I knew Robbie and I had both seen the same thing, so I wasn't going crazy. So we started talking to the guys out there, and they said, well, we had a pretty good hunt, but we're a little over on the birds. And I said something to the effect of, well, what do you mean you're a little over? And he said, We started shooting shovers early this morning, shovers and teal, and he said the mallards didn't start coming in until, you know, on up in the morning, he said. So we're a little over on the birds. I said, oh, okay. And I thought to myself, and he said, the shovers made us do it. And I said, the shovers made you do what? He said, well, you know, we didn't start shooting the mallards till later, so the shovers made us do it. And I thought, you know, everybody, this is on shovers, man, boot lips. And now he's blaming being over the limit on these shovers. It wasn't the shovers' fault they died, but they died first, I guess. So now they're getting blamed for him being over the limit. So
going into this, when he said we're a little over, what in your mind is a little over? What are you thinking?
I'm thinking
they're probably two or three over per person.
Two or three, four ducks, you know, whatever. They got a couple of shovelers, and then they decided they'd go ahead and kill a couple of mallards and do something with the shovelers later. That's what I'm thinking, two or three ducks, you know. So we had checked the six ducks with the guy back at the camp when we saw him leave. So we started counting ducks. And I think it was, I can't remember the exact number, but we started counting ducks, and I want to say there was, 24 ducks that they had between the two of them that were already on their four-wheeler stuff, their four-wheelers parked by the blind. So two guys had like 24 ducks, and then, or 26 ducks. And then Robbie walked into the blind, and in front of the blind, in the brush that was sticking out in front of the blind, were four ducks. And so we assumed that the guy we saw walk out of the blind with the ducks in his hand, that's what he did. He went back in the blind and just threw the ducks out the front of the blind. So Robbie picked up those four ducks, and I said, hey, man, what about these ducks in front of the blind? Oh, well, you know, the dog, when the dog retrieves, he jumps over the front of the blind, and then when he comes back in, sometimes he just drops them right there. And so I said, so you mean to tell me the ducks you just turned around and walked back in there with, these aren't those ducks? Oh, no, no. The dog must have dropped those up there. So I think they had 30 ducks between the two of them. It was something like that. And so we knew we had an over-limit case, and we went ahead and checked their license, their stamps, their plugs, and their shells, and they had everything that they needed, you know. So we grabbed those ducks and said, look, y'all finish packing your stuff up. We've got your ducks. We've got your licenses. We will meet you back at your camp. So Robbie and I drove our four-wheelers back to the truck, loaded up, went over to the duck camp. Well, Robbie said, look, I'm going to just come behind on the turn row, and I'll meet you at the camp. I said, okay, I'm going to drive around in the pickup. You come around, follow them on your four-wheeler. So I got to the camp. And the guy that was there first, I took his six ducks and I laid them on my tailgate. And then I put their other 30 or 32 ducks, whatever it was, that we had just gotten out of the blind, I put them on my tailgate in a separate pile. And we had called Mark Johnson, who was a special agent for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and said, hey, Mark, we got a pretty big over-limit case. Why don't you come over here and meet us and help us sort this out? So we started talking to these guys and said, well, who shot which ducks, you know? Well, I don't know. We don't know. I said, well, did you shoot 10 and you shot 10 and you shot 16? Or, you know, no, we don't know. We were just all shooting. And the one guy with the dog said, well my dog picked up most of them. I don't know how many I shot. So we're sitting there trying to sort this out. And Robbie's coming down the turn row on his four-wheeler, and he stopped. It was some rice levee gate material back there. You know, those old orange gates you put in the rice field?
Yeah.
And he says, hey, Rob. And I looked at him. He was motioning for me to come there. And I said, I can't come over there right now. So I see him bend down, and he picks up his garbage sack. He sets it on the rack of his four-wheeler. He comes driving up. And there were 16 ducks in that garbage sack.
More?
16 more ducks in that garbage sack. So that brought the total ducks to 48. So he brings the sack up there. You know, and they were whole ducks. They weren't breasted and like somebody was going to take them to the trash later or whatever. They were whole, fresh ducks. And I always reach up under a duck's wing, and kind of like in his armpit, put my hands up under the feathers to see if they're still warm or not. And these ducks were still warm. And I said, okay, fellas. I said, who wants to explain the ducks in the sack? And it was like being in a foreign country, speaking a foreign language. They didn't know what we were talking about. Nah, we don't know anything about these 16 ducks in the sack. I said, y'all don't know anything about these 16 ducks in this sack that you just rode right past, and y'all been riding right past all morning. Nope, we don't have a clue how those got there. I don't even have a faintest idea how those got there. And I said, well, that's something. I said, well, reckon the duck fairy left them there last night in exchange for shotgun shells left under the pillow. You know, my smart aleck came out of me. And, no, we don't know anything about these ducks. And I said, oh, okay. I said, well, the Fish and Wildlife Service special agent is on the way. And I said, we're just going to stay out here with the ducks till he gets here. Well, what's the Fish and Wildlife Service coming for? What's the federal game warden coming for? And I said, well, we call him to help us assist in this case. And we're going to wait till he gets here, and maybe he can help us figure out where these 16 ducks came from. So those guys all went inside the duck camp. And I had a video camera at the time. And I think it was out there videoing the ducks on the tailgate. So now we have 48 ducks, you know. We can prove, I guess it was 32 ducks in their possession between the blind and the four-wheeler. The other 16, we just know they're ducks back there. So,
let me ask you this. I want to ask you this for everybody that's listening to this. Is there anything in this world that drives a game warden more crazy than something that appears as wanton waste? Is that your number one pet peeve, or was your number one pet peeve?
Yeah, you know, folks killing stuff and then just leaving it out there, or not even picking up birds, or, you know, shooting and having a bunch of cripples on the water and not going out there and getting them, and then the cripples get away and then shoot more ducks. And that always burned me up. I couldn't stand losing a bird. Everybody loses a bird every once in a while. But
is that the case with most game wardens, though?
Say what?
Yeah, I mean, is that the case with most game wardens? They despise wanton waste.
Yeah, I think so. You know, wanton waste. The definition of wanton waste in the federal law is not making an attempt to retrieve your birds. Mississippi doesn't have this, but other states have it on different game animals, squirrels, deer, you know, rabbits. You've got to take the edible portions of that animal before you discard it. You know, I mean, in Alaska, it's super huge. You got to pack that stuff out. If you get caught leaving a carcass, you're just taking the head. I mean, that's serious in Alaska. Serious here, but other states have it for different animals. And, you know, everybody knows somebody that cuts the back straps out of a deer, cuts the head off, and leaves the rest of the deer. Didn't take the quarters or the neck or the, you know, anything, you know, and that's just a waste. But yeah, I think that pretty much ticks all the game boards off.
So them hiding the ducks in the that's not considered wanton waste, right? That's just trying to hide the wrongdoing that they've done.
That wouldn't be considered wanton waste in terms of federal law, because they did retrieve them. But there's nothing that I am aware of. I may be wrong now, but nothing I'm aware of that says once you retrieve them that you have to eat them or you have to do whatever with them. You know, Mississippi has a law that you can't dump wildlife on the side of a public road or on somebody else's property without permission. But that wasn't what this was. This was just somebody had picked up 16 ducks and hidden them behind a camp in a sack. You know, that's what that was. But anyway, we're sitting out there waiting for the federal game warden to show up. And I guess the guy who claimed to be the head of the camp, he comes walking out and he says, hey, you might want to get your camera ready. I got something I need to say. And I said, okay. And he said, you know, in my old age, sometimes I have a lapse of memory. And I think I remember how those 16 ducks got there. And he said, but first of all, he said, you know who I am, but who are you? And I said, well, I'm Rob Heflin. I'm game warden for the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks. And I said, in fact, you invited me to your camp. I didn't come, but you invited me to your camp two or three times to eat supper over the last year. And he just started laughing. And he said, well, I want you to record this, but I think I remember how those ducks got there. He said, I put those ducks there this morning. And he said, so I'm going to take responsibility for them. And I said, well, sir, I appreciate you owning up to it. I said, I really do appreciate that. I said, but we need to figure out who killed which ducks. They would have never owned up to who killed which duck. So instead of 48 ducks, 16 ducks apiece, 3 times 16. Instead of taking 16 ducks apiece, they wouldn't decide who killed what, so we charged each one of them with 48 ducks, which had been 42 ducks over the limit each. And we send it to federal court. Well, federal court comes along, and sometimes it takes a year or two for a case to get into federal court. And they had pled not guilty to killing over the limit. And so we offered them a deal. Said, well, look, this thing's going to go to court. How about each of you just gets charged with 16 ducks, which would be 10 ducks over the limit each, and a $1,500 fine and 1 year probation. They had a lawyer. The lawyer said, no, they're not going to accept that deal. So
they're
we
called,
went to trial.
They're called red-handed.
Caught red-handed, admitted everything, pled not guilty, didn't want to take the deal of each of them having 10 ducks over the limit. Didn't want that. And they were going to lose their hunt license for a year. And that's why I think they didn't want to accept the deal. So we go to court, and it was a female judge up in Oxford, I believe it was. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was in Oxford. That was that district Whitman County was in. And I go through the whole case, Robbie and I do, what happened that morning and everything. And the judge, she found them guilty. I think she found them guilty of 10 ducks over the limit each. And said that was one of the more egregious cases she had ever heard in her court. She was absolutely disgusted by it. And she fined them, I think it was the $1,500. And put them on 1 year, no hunting anywhere in the world, and told them that for that 1 year, they could not be at their hunting camp while duck season was open. And one of the guys, the main man, he said, well, Judge, I've already booked a pheasant hunt in South Dakota. And she said, no, sir, no hunting anywhere in the world for 1 year. And I thought that fellow was going to start crying right there. Because, like most of us like to hunt and fish, you know, having to go for a year without getting to do it is pretty depressing. And I believe they would have paid several thousand dollars more in fines if the judge had not banned them from hunting for a year. But that's what happened. So that's how that case went.
Woo!
Yeah.
Man. Rob, we're about to... No, go ahead.
I want to say something else about that case. We got to talking about it afterwards, being the other game warden. You know, everybody has those years. Last year was horrible. You got a horrible year. There's no ducks. You paid big money for a lease and all your hunting stuff. And then towards the end of the season, we get that big front that comes through and the ducks show up. And I think this goes through everybody's mind. Well, I'm going to get my ducks now because we hadn't had any ducks the rest of the year. And I think that's what those guys did. You know, they hadn't had a good year, and they just decided they would make up for lost time and ended up getting checked, you know. So I think that thought probably goes through all of our minds. It's been a terrible year, but you just never know when somebody's coming, you know.
Get them while you got them. That's a good stopping place.
Yep.
Well, Rob, we're about out of time. Look, we didn't get as far as we needed and wanted to today because I know we got two or three more stories that we need to cover. Look, at your convenience, when you're down and not flying this week or this weekend while you're in Louisiana, we'll get back together and record another episode. Thank you. Hey, I think it's great to have the other side perspective when it comes to game wardens. Understand what it's like to be in your shoes.
Yeah, and now that I'm not a game warden anymore, I'm down in Louisiana fishing and getting ready to hunt this winter. And, man, I've got that law book, and I read that thing. I go through it with a fine-tooth comb because I want to be right. And I think that's where a lot of guys mess up. They just don't take the time to look at all the details, you know, and then they end up getting caught over it. So I'm one of the rest of the people. I'm just a hunter now like everybody else. So I got to follow all the same rules as everybody. But I enjoyed it, Rocky. I'll talk to you later about some of those.
Hey, I got to ask you this. Is it true? Did you want to write me a ticket while you was a game warden? Do you want to get me?
Well, we'll talk about that next time.
That'll be a good starting point next week.
Yeah.
I'll get your comments on it next week, but I'll leave it at this. I always heard that Rob Heflin wanted to be known as the guy that wrote his best friend a ticket.
I don't know who started that rumor. You'd write your mama a ticket. They said, you'd write your mama a ticket, wouldn't you? Well, I'm just glad she doesn't hunt fish.
That'll be a great starting point for next week. Rob, thank you again. Look, we want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line Podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.